You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.
Hi, everyone. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org on Medscape. This is This Week in Cardiology for July 24th, 2015. This week, I'm going to talk about statins and the high-risk vulnerable plaque. Seeing a vulnerable plaque on a coronary CT scan, the QT interval as a marker of sudden cardiac death risk, trends in atrial fibrillation, and Malcolm Gladwell on healthcare. First up, I wanted to talk about statins and how they work. I'm not sure where this got lost, but maybe with the PCSK9 inhibitors, but the benefits of statins are not solely attributable to lower cholesterol levels. Statins have pleiotropic effects and probably plaque stabilization effects. Recall that statin drugs were proven beneficial in patients for secondary prevention when patients had normal cholesterol levels. So it's in this context that I wanted to mention a small but intriguing observational trial of patients who had acute coronary syndrome and had CTAs as part of their initial evaluation. So these were investigators from the ROMCAT-2 trial, which was originally published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2012, and they presented results of a sub-study of that at the Society for Cardiac CT meeting. For this study, they had 147 patients on statins, 75 patients who were not on statins, and they looked at the CT scans afterwards. So three experts looked at the CT scans, and they found that patients who were taking statin drugs were more likely to have calcified plaque, less likely to have non-calcified plaque, and much less likely to have features of a high-risk plaque. That's a pretty cool observation, and it jives with a recent study from Cleveland Clinic, which found that patients who are on statin drugs had a paradoxical relationship between coronary calcium and atheroma volume. They found that patients on statins had more coronary calcium but less atheroma volume. So these studies may actually visually confirm the whole plaque stabilization idea of statin drugs. And it may also explain the marked difference between statin benefit for primary prevention, which is small, and statin benefit for secondary prevention, which is great. In other words, the more plaque and the more burden of atherosclerosis, the more the benefit. Now, the authors rightly conclude that this is an observational retrospective study and it's hypothesis generating, and we shouldn't make too much of it. So good on them. But I mention it because it gets us away from the sort of old-fashioned view of statins and just cholesterol lowering. So next, I wanted to talk about another coronary CT study, and this one caught my eye because Eugene Brunwald himself wrote the editorial. So when Dr. Brunwald writes an editorial, probably worth taking a look at the study. These were Japanese investigators. This was published in JAC. They looked at more than 3,000 patients for more than 4 years' time. And these patients had coronary CT scans, and the team asked the question of whether the appearance of the plaque predicted acute coronary syndrome in midterm follow-up. And they found that indeed it did. High-risk plaque was found in 10% of patients, but in those 10% of patients, acute coronary syndrome was the risk was increased tenfold. So Brunwald called this a very important topic. He noted that finding high-risk plaques without cardiac catheterization was indeed progress. He also pointed out that numerically speaking, the number of acute coronary syndromes in patients with high-risk plaque and without high-risk plaque were the same. And so that means that having a high-risk plaque, yes, gets your attention, but not having one doesn't inoculate that patient from risk. So another notable aspect of the study, one that gets us back to the old days of cardiology, was that high-risk plaques were not always those that were highly stenosed. These investigators called a high-risk plaque based on things like positive remodeling and low attenuation on the scans. We've recently discussed here at our hospital a patient who had a normal nuclear scan and then a couple days later had an acute coronary syndrome from a proximal coronary lesion. So this may seem like an elemental idea, but atherosclerosis is a diffuse disease, not just a disease of focal stenosis. Next, I wanted to discuss the QT interval and as it may pertain to being a risk factor for sudden cardiac death. There's a lot of talk these days about predicting risk, and the QT interval, I've always been drawn to the QT interval. It's an important thing to look at. It's always been valuable. And in this digital age where the QT measurement might be able to be made reliably on a smartphone, that idea of using the QT interval is even more interesting. So a recent study from a group of Dutch investigators looked at the importance of measuring the QT interval and the consistency of the QT interval. They published their study in Heart Rhythm Journal, and they analyzed serial ECGs from the Rotterdam study, which is a population longitudinal cohort study of more than 10,000 older Dutch men and women. So this sub-study, they had more than 3,400 subjects who had EKGs, serial EKGs, and did not have QT prolongation based on a QT drug or a bundle branch block. And they found some interesting things. Approximately one-third of those with a long QT interval on one EKG had it on a second EKG. So two-thirds of the patients who had one ECG with QT prolongation did not have consistent QT prolongation. And they did a multivariate analysis, and they found that consistent QT prolongation indeed did increase the risk of sudden cardiac death by a factor of at least twofold, but maybe even more based on how they looked at the QT interval correction. But they also found that the risk of sudden cardiac death was not increased in patients who had inconsistent QT prolongation on two ECGs. So this is an interesting observation, one that makes sense given that repolarization time definitely can change with vagal tone and autonomic tone. I've seen patients with a vasovagal episode have a kind of long QT, and then the next day the QT interval is normal. So the key take home is, number one, obviously the QT interval is very important. It's also important to look at serial EKGs. For the fact that two ECGs with consistent QT prolongation may indeed increase risk of sudden cardiac death significantly. And the authors point out in a discussion section that before withholding possibly valuable medications to look at two EKGs. I'm going to be looking for future studies on the QT interval, especially those that look at the QT with mobile technology. Next up are an interesting study in trends in atrial fibrillation. It's no surprise to say that AFib incidence and prevalence are increasing, but it is sort of a surprise to say that AFib-related strokes are decreasing. And these were the main findings of a massive analysis of 50 years of data from the Framingham study. The study, which was published in Lancet, also found that the AF risk factors are changing, namely that obesity and diabetes are contributing more to AFib. And I mention these temporal changes because they bear on the issue of AF screening and AF treatment. The Heart.org on Medscape journalist Pam Harrison got some interesting quotes from Dr. Dan Roden, who's a professor at Vanderbilt, for this story. Dr. Roden wondered whether AFib actually increases risk of mortality, or is it just a marker for increased risk of mortality? And that's a great question. And the more we learn about atrial fibrillation, the more it becomes clear that in many cases, AFib stems from cardiometabolic risk factors. And correction of those risk factors decreases AF burden. Another interesting question from the study is that why are stroke rates from AFib decreasing? Is it because we're detecting more patients with AFib that are lower risk, or perhaps it's because of anticoagulation? And I think that difference matters, right? It matters for screening because One downside of screening populations for AFib is that we may pick up more low-risk individuals that benefit the least from AF treatment and AF anticoagulation. But the counter to that point is, of course, that identifying AFib earlier in the course may push us to aggressively treat risk factors like obesity and sleep apnea, hypertension, and diabetes. And treating those risk factors is obviously not just going to improve AF, but it's also going to improve mortality and patient outcomes. So take a look at that story. I think this is really interesting in how we're thinking about atrial fibrillation as a disease or a symptom of a disease. And finally, I want to close this week by pointing you to a terrific feature on theheart.org, a five-star feature. Editor-in-Chief Dr. Eric Topol sat down with Malcolm Gladwell to discuss what ails the U.S. healthcare system. And you've probably already seen this interview. It's gotten a lot of attention, but if you haven't, it's well worth your time. And I personally was tingling with delight when I heard a famous writer like Gladwell connect insurance reform with the virtues of slow medicine. I love slow medicine, and this hit all of my confirmation bias centers to hear a guy like Gladwell say that he thought it was valuable as well. So that's it for this week. Until next week, this is John Mandrola on the heart.org on Medscape.
You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.